Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
What up? What up? Hello, folks. It's Michael Steele. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. Yes, I'm back after a raucous week here in Washington. We've got a knockdown, drag out over impeachment. And then, of course, you've got the fireworks that you're seeing on the Democratic Party. Right? This is such a great week in America. Just so much going on. So glad you can be a part of it. You know, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitchers, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcast on. And certainly you can find me on Twitter at Michael Steele. Well, you know, I thought that given all of the machinations and movements this week, that it'd be a lot of fun to have someone on who is an insider outsider, someone who knows what the ground troops are doing on the inside, but also has his hand in shaking things up on the outside. And no one better to talk about that than Reid Galen, who is an independent political strategist. Unfortunately for fans like myself, he left the Republican Party in 2016, but we're working to get the brother back. Hey Reid, I'm like a Motel 6 brother. I got the lights on, so you know he can come back anytime.
No, I appreciate that.
Reid has spent the last 3 years dedicated to the political reform movement, which we want to get into with him. Creating a better system for all voters. In fact, he serves as one of the founding advisors to the Lincoln Project. He's also a veteran public affairs and political professional with more than 20 years experience. And you see this guy, he's like, you know, this young, straight out of high school look. But, you know, he's been in the game a long time. And Reid has also been involved in politics, government, business at the highest levels. He served as deputy campaign manager for John McCain's presidential campaign and deputy campaign manager for Arnold Schwarzenegger's successful 2006 reelection campaign. And it was important to note all that. So when we get into this conversation, folks, you understand why I say he's good on the inside and the outside, because he's been in those spaces. Reid, welcome to the podcast, man.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks for having me.
So I didn't even know where to start. To start with the fun with the Democrats or start with the fun with impeachment? But we'll go with impeachment, since that is
sure.
The most significant thing that's happening right now. You've got the articles of impeachment signed, sealed, and now delivered to the Senate. Mm-hmm. What's your take in looking at how this played out, starting with the decision by Nancy Pelosi to hold those articles of impeachment for a month before delivering them to the Senate? And then, of course, the mm-hmm. Republicans' reactions to all of that now that the process is beginning.
Sure. So I think that a couple things. One is that, you know, whether or not you agree with Speaker Pelosi on her policy, stances, right. she's been a longtime D.C. warrior. She probably knows the rules and the rhythms of certainly the House, but certainly also the Capitol at large, probably as well, if not better than anybody.
Right.
And I think she also had, I think if yesterday, you know, the last 2 days, I don't want to call them discoveries, but release of, materials related to all of the stuff going on in Ukraine, or any indication, she probably had a pretty good idea that something was going to happen on that front. And that, with Lev Parnas and his interview with Rachel Maddow last night and all these other things, whether or not it's evidentiary in Trump's trial, it certainly made life a lot harder for leader Senator Mitch McConnell and those swing Republicans like Martha McSally or Susan Collins, to say, you know, we're going to make this short, we're going to make this sweet, we're just going to say, you know, he's innocent and we're going to move on with our lives. I think she understood that they're now in a bind. This stuff looks really, really bad. I mean, to call these guys, you know, the international version of Keystone Cops right. is an insult to Keystone Cops.
Right. That is so true. But I'm sitting here high-fiving myself right now because you're one of the few who've brought the same analysis to this that I have, that I did not see what Nancy did as a problem. I didn't see it as a negative. Uh-huh. In fact, I thought it was one of the more smart strategic moves that she could make given the cards that she'd been dealt in the first instance, meaning the fact that, you know, throughout the impeachment inquiry process, the White House didn't cooperate. The Justice Department is downright untrustworthy. I mean, you know, our Attorney General basically is a political hack for the president. So to be able to maneuver this conversation to the point now where you've got Republicans, some Republicans, Mitt Romney among them, saying, you know, yeah, we want to look at witnesses. I thought that was one of the asymmetrical moves of the year because no one saw it coming, and no one thought, even if they saw it sitting over there in the wings somewhere, oh, she'd never go there, and she did.
Right. Right. Well, I think, you know, look, I think one of the, you know, in some ways it's good, in some ways it's bad. But, you know, the president has, you know, he's pushed beyond the bounds of the envelope, right? What might have been considered legitimate or acceptable 3 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, you know, is, you know, those things might have been unacceptable then. They're acceptable now. And I think also, again, you know, these are high stakes things. The president, you know, utilized his office to try and take out, you know, what he still considers to be his prime, you know, nemesis, you know, on the Democratic side as a potential nominee is concerned. And think about that. That really, this is where that all leads back to. I mean, think about that, right? This all leads back to the idea that he was worried most about Joe Biden. He thought he had an open shot to take him out. And instead of letting the Democrats do the work themselves, which they might have done,
right?
You know, he did what Donald Trump does, which is he sends crazy Rudy Giuliani to Ukraine to do God knows what. And then, you know, we are where we are. Whereas if, you know, he had just kept his powder dry like any normal human being, you know, Biden's Democratic opponents might have made the Burisma thing an issue in their own right. But once Trump and Giuliani got involved, the Dems circled the wagons, and now we are where we are.
Well, so, can you imagine the conversations after Rudy left the room in Ukraine? How people sitting there scratching, going, what the hell do we do with this guy? What are you kidding me?
Right.
And, of course, you have a new president coming in Zelensky, who ran on the idea of cleaning up the corruption that was rampant across his country. Now being pulled, sucked into this corrupt scheme to give right. cover to the president of the United States. So you sit there and you scratch your head. You know, Hollywood couldn't write this script any better than Trump has written it himself. And then sits right. back and wonders why everybody's looking at him saying, well, you know, this is impeachable because you're using your office to leverage against your political opponent in the upcoming election. And he doesn't seem to think there's anything wrong with that. So you reference Parnas, who is now become this other central player, who, if regardless of what you think about Parnas and mm-hmm. you know, sort of the, you know, Rudy's bagman montage that we've heard over time, you know, the various stories about that and that, you know, his credibility here and there. He did connect sure. dots. He is connecting dots with legitimate witnesses who've already testified to what they saw or heard or were directly involved in regarding some of these players.
Sure. Yeah, no, I mean, look, I think that this, you know, and again, this is one of these things that, you know, maybe I know very little about the New York real estate business, or anything else. But what's amazing to me is that not just that guys like Lev Parnas find, find their way to the sides of Rudy Giuliani, you know, Kevin McCarthy and the president of the United States, but the ease with which he seemed to have done it.
Right.
He does just show up and they they're taking all the thumbs up and MAGA photos they can. And, you know, they realize, you know, it's like, you know, Hal Holbrook in All the President's Men.
Right.
You know, these are not bright guys and things got out of hand. These guys make the Watergate burglars, you know, look like a bunch of Einsteins running around. I mean, it just, and so, you know, whether or not it's, you know, the stuff with the, you know, with the ambassador and, you know, again, to your point about President Zelensky, you know, just take one look at the looks on his face, you know, when there've been public photographs of him having to sit next to President Trump, you know, he's either slumped in his chair, he's rolling his eyes. This is the guy who just like, he got sucked into this thing by this, you know, maelstrom of morons, for lack of a better way to put it. And, you know, all he wants to do, and he's got the Russian bear on one side and he's got Donald Trump on the other. I mean, this is a guy who is not living his best life right now.
Right. And he just puts the sign around his neck, shoot me now. You know, that's
right.
Because that's his option at this point, sitting between Trump and Putin, getting squeezed at both ends by these guys. Is not a good space for someone like Zelensky, who globally was recognized as a reformer, having to deal with two very corrupt individuals. And the piece about the Parnas piece for me is interesting because, as I said, not only is he connecting dots and sort of verifying information that's already been testified to, but then to watch folks like Devin Nunes, you know, who a month ago was like, I don't know this guy. I don't recall any conversation. I have to check my records, but I'd say Parnas. Mm-hmm. No, I don't. And then last night on Fox is like, well, you know, apparently he called my cell phone and just a boom, boom, boom. And we were done and nothing, no big deal. I told him to talk to my staff and it's like, wait a minute, dude, you go from I don't know him to, oh, yeah, it was just a quick boom, boom, boom. So everybody has your cell phone. They just call you as the chairman of your committee and just like, you know, you're chairman of oversight.
Right.
So, oh, okay, whatever. Why are we such suckers for such bullshit? I don't understand. I don't understand how people look at someone like Devin Nunes and Jim Jordan inside the Republican family and go, yeah, that's the standard bearer we want out there representing us. Let's get the craziest, most whacked out ass possible to say the most insane shit. Yeah, that's what we want to stand behind. How does that happen?
You know, so I think it's you know, it was a process that it was, I want to say it was, you know, that there's that old quote, right? Nothing happens and then nothing happens and then everything happens.
Right.
And so I think that for a lot of these Republican members, whether or not they're in the House or the Senate, and when I say this, please understand that I am by no means exonerating them. I'm just trying to examine their behavior because it is, you know, there is no way out for them, I think, in a lot of these ways, is that, you know, Trump is, you know, elected unexpectedly. They think, okay, well, this guy's, he's pretty kooky and he goes off and he says all these crazy things. There's no reason to mess with him, right?
Right.
He goes off and he says, you know, whatever, you know, pick your thing, Charlottesville, tariffs, you know, the wall, the cages, you know, whatever it is. And suddenly they find themselves like they sort of took a step into the quicksand and they say, oh, it's not so bad. And then, or use whatever metaphor, whether or not it's the boiling frog or getting caught in quicksand, whatever it is. But by the time they looked up and realized what was happening, they were too deep in and they couldn't get out, or they can't get out. And so now it's, you know, you take a Susan Collins or a Cory Gardner or a Martha McSally, and, you know, Martha McSally's on CNN this morning, you know, calling a CNN reporter a hack, you know, a liberal hack and all these other things. So they're clearly feeling this pressure, but now it's, do you risk the wrath of Donald Trump saying terrible things about you on Twitter and save yourself at home? Or do you save yourself at home, and potentially convict the president of the United States? And so like they decided to stand in the middle of the road as Trump was driving his semi truck toward them. They're now likely to get run over, and a lot of them are going to lose their jobs this fall. And, you know, I don't feel bad for them.
Well, and we're going to get into some of the work that you and Steve Schmidt and others are doing to make sure, if nothing else, they're held accountable on that front. And I happen to agree with you. So you've got this backdrop on the Republican side, which is a hell house of crazy. And everybody is kind of like, whatever dear leader says, we will do. And they go out and they do it. On the Democratic side, you've got the steely conviction and nerve of Nancy Pelosi. If folks who listen to the podcast know, I'm the first to admit just how politically savvy the Speaker of the House is. She is incomparable in her capabilities. I mean, there's no one in Washington right now, I think, have the political kahunas that she has, and be able to use that the way she has very effectively. And yet and still, you have some Democrats who are gnashing their teeth and wringing their hands over impeachment, not doing impeachment, and then once you decide to do impeachment, over you're not doing it fast enough to, okay, now that we're doing it, oh my God, we're not going to be able to get witnesses. I said on on Jonathan Capehart's podcast a while back, just two words, trust Nancy in this. She's seeing something that a lot of people in politics aren't seeing right now, and is able to sort of navigate this narrative through the work of her committee chairman to get us to this point where I think going into this, and I'm very curious about how you see this upcoming trial now in light of what's been done. I think she set this thing up where people will actually pay attention from a serious perspective. I think before, if she had just turned those documents over before Christmas, Mitch McConnell would have shat all over them and said, right, you know what, there's really no need to have a trial here because this is just all BS, so we're going to move on. And the country would have yawned because it's the holidays, and I'd much rather open up a Christmas present than open up a, impeachment article. But right now, I think folks are going to be engaged a little differently. How do you see it?
No, I think that's right. And I think, the one thing is, especially as long as you and I have been in politics, we always think about these things, that, everybody's a strategist, right? But right, the truth is most of us are tacticians, right? We're really good at making a TV ad or coming up with the pithy soundbite.
Right.
But there are very few people who sort of are able to take the long view and say, okay, I know where I want to end up. How am I going to make that happen? And I think that Speaker Pelosi clearly, I think, demonstrated, her abilities as a battlefield general to say, okay, I know that, there are all these different variables out there. I know that, McConnell's going to do whatever he's going to do, but I'm going to just sit and keep my powder dry until I know the time is right. And then I will strike. And now what you see happening with, McConnell tried this motion to dismiss, went over like a lead balloon.
Right.
Now you've got Collins and others, sort of agitating potentially for witnesses. And then, you pile on the stuff with Parnas, as we've mentioned previously. And so she knew that, like, it's going to come to a point where, is Donald Trump going to be, acquitted? Probably. Right. But it's going to be a hell of a lot more painful and difficult process to get there. Will they lose any Republicans? Probably not. But it's going to be something that, and this is, I think, also where she really understands it, is that she's genius at getting inside the president's head.
Oh, my gosh.
And all of this stuff is directly aimed at getting inside his head. And I think that, in the short term politics of it, he'll do whatever it is he's going to do, whether or not it's say something crazy at his rallies or go off on Twitter or say something stupid to a reporter. But that's par for the course. But to your point about people tuning in now, I think people out, like what I call the Casey Star test, right? Actual Americans going about their lives, doing their work, who, to them, this has been a sideshow. Maybe they see a little bit of light and they feel a little bit of heat, but this is now going to probably spill, the crucible will break and will spill out into the hinterlands. Probably the last time we saw this was like with the Kavanaugh hearings, right? Where things became so superheated that it sort of reached out into the countryside. And I think you're going to see that here too. And I think for someone like Trump, you want to talk about the Democrats, we'll get to them in a minute, but remember that his margins in those states totaled 77,000 votes, right? Mm-hmm. And he was going up against someone where he and Hillary had a combined negative rating of like 119%.
Yeah, I know,
so, like, literally everything had to fall in place for him to be where he is today.
Right,
he
exactly.
has no margin, right?
Right?
So all of those, you know, let's say female suburban voters who voted, you know, on policy issues in 2018 in those suburban districts, who probably, if the Democrats can put up anybody reasonably acceptable, those voters will not come back to Trump, right? They couldn't vote for Hillary maybe because they hadn't liked her for 25 years.
Right.
Right. And so they
right.
said, okay,
no, I ain't doing that. No.
Right. But now it's like, okay, well, I've got so-and-so or so-and-so. Like, maybe I'm not huge on them with policy, but like maybe they'll stop tweeting and I don't have to hear about them every day. Right.
Well, you know, you hit on a number of very salient points, and then it kind of, for me, boiled down to this one thing that I noticed among all the other things that have happened. What is Trump tweeting about? Almost every tweet now, he says something akin to, I don't understand why I've got to have it, why impeachment is going to be part of the opening of my biography. You can see where his head is in the long run. Whether or not he gets acquitted doesn't matter anymore for him. I think
right.
what's really sunk in now, and Nancy nailed it. She nailed it
yep.
when she said, you know, regardless of what happens in the Senate, he will forever be impeached. He will forever
right.
be one of three presidents of the United States to have been impeached. And
right.
that among all the other things you do, however great or small, as president, to have as the opening paragraph the fact that you are historic for being impeached is not something Trump really relishes at all. And that burns him
yes.
in such a fundamental way.
It does. And it is, again, one of those things where, you know, I think we've seen over the past 3 years, maybe even going back to 15 when he first got in the race, that no one knew how to deal with him. People have found it difficult to figure out how to make things stick to Donald Trump,
right?
Right? They can't figure out, you know, he's a bully. He's, you know, he lashes out. And, you know, there's, I think, you know, still a misconception of, you know, among both Republicans and Democrats about how you have to go after him because they've never had to do this before. But his insecurities are, you know, big flashing spotlights, right? He's, you know, he was born in Queens. He always wanted to be accepted into the Manhattan money set. He
right.
wasn't, he was elected president unexpectedly. He wants to be accepted into the political set. He is only because he's, you know, theoretically leader of the free world and has all this control and everything else, but he's still a highly insecure guy. Right. And to your point, like, his image to him is everything, right? I mean, he is not unlike the buildings upon which he puts his name on, right?
Yeah.
The buildings don't belong to him. Therefore, theoretically or metaphorically, they're empty. Trump is just a Trump Tower, you know, in human form. There's nothing on the inside. The only thing that matters to him is what he looks like on the outside. And so impeachment is a stain. And, you know, let's give Richard Nixon an honorary spot. But now, you know,
it's like having pigeon
Richard
shit
Nixon.
All over the awning.
Right. And so now you're going to have, you know, if we add Nixon in an honorary capacity, you know, then Trump is on the Mount Rushmore of impeachment in American history. Right.
Ouch.
And so I think that, you know, this is something that probably gets to him and will get to him for the rest of his life. And I think that, you know, if Democrats are smart, they'll understand that, yes, you have to find the policy prescriptions. And he's had plenty of bad policy, too. But there is a piece that has to go directly at him in order to get him to do the things that, you know, will drive away those independent and swing voters.
All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break because you just opened up a perfect door to go through to talk about what's happening on the left. And we're going to do that with our great guest, Reed Galen, right after this.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in health care. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
All right, welcome back, everybody, to the podcast. We're having a great conversation with Reed Galen. And so, Reed, before we took the break there, you sort of walked into a new space that I want to get into, and that is what we're seeing happening on the other side of the aisle relative to the question of impeachment and the Democratic candidates for office, how all of this is playing out for them. Let's take a quick listen to Biden. Talking about how impeachment will impact, could impact, the presidential.
Tomorrow, the Speaker Nancy Pelosi will send articles of impeachment against President Trump to the United States Senate, launching the third trial of a U.S. president. The Republican-led Senate has signaled that it is likely to acquit him. Vice President Biden, if you're the nominee, is it going to be harder to run against President Trump if he's been acquitted and able to claim vindication, especially after what he said about your family?
It's irrelevant. There's no choice but for Nancy Pelosi and the House to move. He has, in fact, committed impeachable offenses. Whether the Senate makes that judgment or not, it's for them to decide. But, and by the way, I'm told that, you know, we, that I don't, I say we have to unite the country, and it's going to be harder after this trial. It may be. But look, you know, I understand how these guys are, this Republican Party. They've gone after, savaged my surviving son, gone after me, told lies that your networks and others won't even carry on television because they're flat out lies. And I did my job. The question is whether or not he did his job, and he hasn't done his job. And so it doesn't really matter whether or not he's gone after me. I've got to be in a position that I think about the American people. I can't hold a grudge. I have to be able to not only fight, but also heal. And as President of the United States, that's what I will attempt to do, notwithstanding that we're going to be more division after he's defeated by me this next time.
So Biden is essentially saying, bring it. I don't see impeachment as necessarily a sidebar or even sidetracking the race against Trump. What's your take on that?
Well, I think he's probably right in that, you know, as we know that, you know, the presidential elections come down to, you know, charisma, slogans, you know, events outside of anybody's perception or control. And so I think, you know, this is, you know, I mean, the fact that we're here, frankly, you know, given Trump's past and even, you know, from the moment he took office, like none of this should be surprising, right? It was probably only a matter of time when he was going to, you know, step into a bear trap and find himself in this kind of trouble. And so right. What I think Biden is saying is probably the right thing, which is like, we still got to go run a campaign. I still got to tell the American people why I'm going to be a better president than this guy. And that doesn't mean I'm not going to take the gloves off and go after him when I need to. But you know what? You got a campaign to prosecute, and you can't. I mean, here's the thing. As you know, so much of what Donald Trump is and who he is and how he acts, it's not a secret to everybody. Everybody knows the guy's an asshole, right? So like, you don't, that's not right. News to anybody.
Right. Right.
So you have to find, you have to find new and different avenues by which you can beat him, not only on the political front, but I think again, also on the policy front.
How do you think the left should approach this? I've argued for over a year now that if I'm, you know, given the work that I've done in politics, the elections that I've been involved in, the assessment of candidates that I've done, you know, opponent, you know, sort of oppo research kind of thing. My argument is Biden is the guy who I think stands the best chance of going toe-to-toe and taking down Trump. In other words, getting those three bricks to put back in the blue wall that Trump took, Wisconsin, mm-hmm. Michigan, and Pennsylvania. How do you see it? Can they win this with an Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders? That the country would look past their policy prescriptions on health care and education and the environment to say, we don't care. We just want a physical body there that we can vote for to defeat Trump. Or does that become a bar for them, for those candidates? And then someone like a Biden is more palatable because he seemingly closer to where the country is as a whole.
Sure.
Do you assess all of that?
I mean, I think on paper, yeah, I think that the vice president is probably, you know, more in line with where the country is. I think he's probably more relatable to the places that you mentioned. He is a product of Eastern Massachusetts, right? Scranton. So he's got that sort of, Midwest labor sensibility. He's obviously very strong with African-American voters who stayed home in droves in places like Detroit last time. And so I think that, again, if we were just looking at the lineups, I think the vice president makes a very compelling case. I would also say, the Democratic nominating process has taken a turn. They always do, as you know.
Yep.
And I've always been sort of surprised why everybody thinks that this is, something new and novel when, only one person can be the nominee. Right. So the idea that somehow, eventually four or five lanes has to get into one and there's going to be some car crashes along the way is no surprise. Do I think that it's a tougher electoral road for Senator Warren or Senator Sanders? I think it does, but you're also talking to a guy who was convinced that Hillary Clinton was going to get 340 electoral votes.
Right.
So, for all the time I've spent in politics, like, what the hell do I know?
Right.
Right. and again, I think, we shouldn't think about these things in a vacuum, right? I mean, even if let's say a Bernie Sanders, again, on paper does not appear to be someone who could swing, Midwestern voters, African-American voters, people of color. But President Trump truly goes off the deep end in such a way that, like, even, let's say that he goes from 85% support among Republicans to 65. Well, then you very well might have a President Bernie Sanders.
How do you see this then playing out, the impeachment storyline playing out for the electorate? Now, we talked about the Democratic Party. How about for the voters as a whole? How much of this are they going to take in and use as a metric in their assessment of who should be the next president of the United States?
So, I mean, I think it's 40-20-40 equation, right? Mm-hmm. There's 40% of people who loathe the guy and want to see him in prison. And there's 40% of people, for argument's sake, who think that Donald Trump is the chosen one and should be president forever. And then we always have the 20%, and maybe that's too much in the middle. Let's call it, maybe it's 10 to 15%. I don't know, but the people who are ultimately going to decide. And I think that the issue for President Trump with those people is that, again, maybe they felt like they didn't have a choice among, two legitimate candidates. I don't want to say legitimate, but two reasonable candidates last time. And so if they were going to choose between Hillary Clinton, who was sort of the dynasty and more of the same, or Donald Trump, who was drastic and radical change, which is maybe what they wanted, then they went for Trump. But now, after three, years of it, those folks are sort of, maybe they're tired. Maybe they've just had it. Maybe they are looking for that other option. And so I think that what impeachment could do for voters like that is push them further into the, frankly, undecided piece, right? Maybe they were leaning Trump before because it's a good economy or whatever it is. But now it's like, it's just, there's too much. It's just, I can't deal with it anymore. I just want the noise to stop. The guy, I've always known the guy was sort of dirty and now he's just proven it. And, that's not what I want in a president. And so I think that, and as you know, a lot of these things are going to be emotional too, right? It's going to be a visceral reaction to, what they're seeing. And I think if the Democrats during the course of the trial come off as sober and serious and lay out the facts, I think that's going to be, to their advantage politically, because we can almost be assured that the Republicans will be, hair on fire and saying that this is all a witch hunt and everything else.
Well, the other underlying storyline that I think pushes and pulls at the narrative on the left, as you described it, is the Bernie Sanders supporters, who are a lot like Trump supporters. There is folks, as you've heard me talk about this before, such a thing as a Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump voter. I've met them. I've talked to them. They're real people. And so there's something about that Bernie Sanders voter that takes their politics a lot like a Trump voter very, very personally. And so when you saw in the 2016 cycle the inevitable tensions that grew between the two campaigns, especially given post-primary, where essentially Bernie Sanders did not campaign for Hillary Clinton. He didn't really support her. He was not out front the way you would think a traditional candidate who's been defeated, you know, have done in the past. They go and say, oh, yeah, I'll help the ticket and do our thing.
Yeah.
I had a couple of Bernie Sanders supporters say to me, yeah, we're still waiting for him to show up for that endorsement rally that he was going to do for Hillary. So that's how deep it runs for them. You're starting to see the same thing begin to develop among the Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren voter. And it all came a little bit to a head this week when Elizabeth Warren, a year later, talks about a dinner that she and Bernie had. They had lasagna. And the course of that meal, he indicated to her that a woman could not get elected president. So this question, of course, inevitably came up during the debate. Let's take a listen to how Sanders responded to that.
CNN reported yesterday that, and Senator Warren confirmed in a statement, that in 2018, you told her that you did not believe that a woman could win the election. Why did you say that?
Well, as a matter of fact, I didn't say it. And I don't want to waste a whole lot of time on this because this is what Donald Trump and maybe some of the media want. Anybody knows me, knows that it's incomprehensible that I would think that a woman could not be president of the United States. Go to YouTube today. There's a video of me 30 years ago talking about how a woman could become president of the United States. In 2015, I deferred, in fact, to Senator Warren. There was a movement to draft Senator Warren to run for president. And you know what? I said, stayed back. Senator Warren decided not to run, and I did run afterwards. Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by 3 million votes. How could anybody in a million years not believe that a woman could become president of the United States? And let me be very clear. If any of the women on this stage or any of the men on this stage win the nomination, I hope that's not the case. I hope it's me. But if they do, I will do everything in my power to make sure that they are elected in order to defeat the most dangerous president in the history of our country.
So, Senator Sanders, I do want to be clear here. You're saying that you never told Senator Warren that a woman could not win the election.
That is correct.
And the kicker for me, Reed, was then she turns, this reporter turns to Senator Warren and says, so Senator Warren, what did you say when Bernie Sanders said a woman couldn't get elected president? I was like, did you not hear the man just say he didn't say it? And the fact that she started the question, the question wasn't, did you say that? The question is, why did you say that? So Bernie was automatically put in this position where it was presumed he said something he claimed he didn't say. And then, of course, he denies it. Warren gets upset about it. And then they have this moment, which CNN captured off mic at the end when Elizabeth Warren walks up to Bernie Sanders and says this.
I think you called me a liar on national TV. I think you called me a liar on national TV.
Let's not do it right now. You want to have that discussion, we'll have that discussion. You called me. You told me. All right, let's not do it now.
I think you called me a liar. Yeah, I did call you a liar on national stage because I didn't say it. So that would have been me if I didn't say it. What?
Right.
How does this play out and what does it mean, if anything? This just could be, you know, so exciting because we're not talking about Trump. So everybody's like, oh, yeah, let's spend time on this. But how does this work into this narrative between these two camps going forward?
Well, I think that, you know, it's interesting because I don't hear, you know, the way you started about, you know, the Bernie Sanders supporters being so close to, you know, sort of in, I don't want to say makeup, but they could slip on any day to be Trump or Sanders voters, right?
Right.
I think Warren voters, you know, might be equally progressive, but it's a more intellectual thing,
yeah,
right?
they're not going to flip over to
Trump.
Trump, yeah, not at all.
Right, they might stay home if they didn't get as progressive a choice as they wanted to, but they wouldn't go to Trump.
Right,
and so yeah, look, I think this is one of those things where, you know, the way that the you know, look, I think that especially, you know, where we are today, you know, with the Me Too movement and everything else, I think that you know, the idea that anybody, especially a nearly 80-year-old white guy, would say, you know, a woman can't be president, is incendiary, especially among a Democratic primary, right? And you shouldn't say it because it's not true,
right?
Right. I think that, you know, if a female nominee, you know, I don't, if Barack Obama can be president of the United States, a woman can be president of the United States, right? That's just,
right.
So I think we're just sort of stuck in these old tropes. But I think what it pointed to was, you know, they were trying to bring it to a head, and the way they did it, sort of, you know, it sort of put Bernie on the spot, but it, you know, gave Warren an out, but it didn't really make them address, you know, who, you know, the literal he said, she said, and that's the other part too, is that if it's just the two of them, we're never going to know who said what,
right?
We have to, we'll just have to take it at their word.
Why
and so
why
my
she,
guess is their supporters are going to do that.
Right. So why should bring it up a year later? Why now? Why 3 weeks before Iowa? If this was such a burning issue for her and she was so offended by it, why did she wait a year to bring it up as opposed to at the very beginning of her campaign, lay down the gauntlet by saying, you know, something along the lines of, yeah, there's some even within my own party who believe that a woman can't be, and just put it out there. But why 3 weeks before Iowa? And see, this is my problem, because I think this was a setup. I think this was all contrived to gain back momentum going into the last debate before the Iowa caucuses, and to sort of create a firestorm to and a drag, honestly, on the Bernie Sanders campaign. And that's just my political mind thinking, because
sure.
I come from the perspective of if it's something that cuts deep into your soul as an individual or your belief system, you talk about that shit up front. I don't sit on that for a year. I mean, that's because that's the animus of my campaign. That's why I'm running, to prove this particular lie is a lie.
So, I mean, I would say a couple of things. One, and you pointed to sort of the you know, how campaigns and politics play out. One is, you know, as you know, the Warren campaign, look, she's run a good campaign. She has been a good candidate, right? And she had a head of steam going through the summer and has seen her, you know, that momentum has come to a screeching halt. And now, you know, she's still, you know, in the top three or four in every survey.
Right.
But clearly Big Mo has left her. Right.
Right.
And so, you know, whether or not it's contrived or not, I can't speak to. But you also know that there are times in campaigns where you have those things that you keep in the in Pandora's box. And, you know, it's,
yeah,
you know,
fair.
Break glass in case of emergency. And, you know, if she'd done it a year ago, you know, would it have kneecapped Bernie Sanders' campaign? I don't think so, because I think he probably would have denied it then, too. And then it would have been sort of played out over the course of the year. Here it's now, you know, especially the caucus voters and the New Hampshire primary voters are now tuning in, right? It has the ability to, you know, lock in some of Warren's supporters to say, she's our person. But also, again, she and Bernie were going to have to come to a head. And I even wrote about this, I think, in USA Today, like 2 months ago. They occupy the same policy space,
right?
So, ultimately, somebody was going to have to do something. Someone was going to have to throw a punch. You know, and we heard, was it the week prior that, you know, someone on Bernie's campaign had phone scripts that were going after Warren, and, you know, and maybe this is the response to that. But none of this, again, as we talked about earlier, should be a surprise. You know, who said what, again, we're never going to know. These voters are going to have to take it on faith. But what I will say is that it's probably bad for both of them, excuse me, ultimately, because, you know, that sort of ugliness. You know, I think voters would like to like their candidates. I think Democrats really want to love their candidates.
Right.
But it's also interesting because, as you talked about, there's very little crossover between these two, right? Bernie Sanders voters aren't going to go to Warren, and Warren voters very well might not go to Sanders. And so, you know, does that accrue to Biden or Klobuchar or, you know, Buttigieg or Yang? I mean, any of the folks who are still sort of hanging out there who have lots of money, right, and aren't going anywhere until probably at least Super Tuesday.
So all of that is sort of the fodder, the energy behind a new movement that you are a part of. In an op-ed that George Conway, Steve Schmidt, John Weaver, and Rick Wilson wrote back in December, the lead-off paragraph starts, "Patriotism and the survival of our nation in the face of the crimes, corruption, and corrosive nature of Donald Trump are a higher calling than mere politics. As Americans, we must stem the damage he and his followers are doing in the rule of law, to the rule of law, the Constitution, and the American character." With that, the Lincoln Project was born. Tell us, what is the Lincoln Project? What impact is it going to have or hopes to have over the next 9 months of this campaign? And even beyond that, what are some of the goals that you're trying to establish?
Sure. Well, I think we started talking about this. Well, I mean, look, I can't speak for most of the other folks, but I mean, as you noted at the open, you know, I left the party back in 2016 as soon as Trump became the nominee.
Right.
Simply because, you know, look, I grew up in the party, right?
Yeah.
For your DC listeners, you know, other kids went to summer camp and I went to Capitol Hill, right?
That's
I spent my summers at the NRCC.
That's right.
So, like, I mean, I literally was born into the party and was lucky enough to work for, you know, then Governor Bush and then ultimately President Bush and on through the years. And so, for me, you know, I worked for President Bush when he was governor of Texas. This was a guy who was, you know, pro-education reform, pro-immigration, pro-prosperity. And so, you know, nowadays he's considered a moderate, right? Because he's, you know, he was actually looking for, you know, positive ways to impact people's lives. And so, you know, it came to a head for me when I said, if this is what the party is looking for in a leader, then that's just not me anymore. And I would venture to say that on some level, the other guys are sort of in a similar vein.
Right.
But the bottom line is this, is that, you know, we have political parties. They have stratified now. They are just, you know, as Lee Drutman in his new book says, they are now truly distinct from one another. Right. There are very few Rockefeller Republicans or Blue Dog Democrats. And for us, you know, the bigger issue is this, is that, you know, Donald Trump, I believe, is, you know, we all believe, is a threat to the republic institutionally, politically, you know, overseas and at home. He gets into these fights, you know, whether or not it's, you know, getting in trade wars with China, or, you know, the things that he believes are totally acceptable vis-a-vis, you know, how they treat people at the border. And for us, you know, that it was just, it's all been a bridge too far. And so what we have committed ourselves to is defeating Donald Trump this coming November. And, you know, we're policy agnostic, right? Like, we have one job, we have one mission, and that's to make sure Donald Trump is a one-term president at the ballot box on November 3rd. The follow-on piece of that, too, though, is that there are a lot of folks who, you know, were probably, you know, in a time of a President Jeb Bush or a President Marco Rubio are soaring to re-election, who are now, you know, stuck in the, you know, mid 40s in their reelection campaigns in states like Colorado, Arizona, you know, North Carolina or Maine, or now even Iowa, perhaps, because they have been, as we talked about earlier, sort of taken over by Trumpism. And rather than saying, you know, I might be a conservative, which Trump, I think, is certainly not, and we could do a whole podcast on that,
right.
You know, have gone along to get along. And, you know, from my perspective, knowing something is wrong and doing nothing about it, knowing something is wrong and saying nothing about it, it makes you complicit, right? You are guilty by omission, if not commission. And you have decided that, you know, you don't want to endure what I probably believe would be short-term pain from someone like Donald Trump, in order to sort of stand, you know, for the Constitution and by your oath. And therefore, I think you see, you know, Gardner is, you know, is going to be in a life or death race against John Hickenlooper.
Yeah.
Mark Kelly is, you know, is on the run, you know, or Martha McSally is on the run from Mark Kelly in Arizona. And even Tom Tillis in a place like North Carolina, right, is, you know, has gone to a toss-up race. And I think that there's probably a direct line between their, you know, sort of toadying stances on the president and how much trouble they're having at home.
How does the Lincoln Project go about doing this? What are you guys? How are you going to engage this fall? You're backing certain candidates. You're raising money. What exactly are you? How are you manifesting your efforts to hold everyone accountable?
Well, sure. So, I mean, I think a couple things. One is that I think there are several different ways to go about this. One is you know, with the president, as we talked about earlier, there are ways, and I think that some of the guys on our team, specifically like a George Conway and a Rick Wilson, are, you know, almost preternaturally able to find their way into the president's head.
Right.
And so we will find different ways to get into his head and stay there.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that if you're in his head, he acts badly. And the worse he acts, the more he turns voters off. And so that seems silly. But how many other presidents do you know that you can run an ad on Fox News and he will tweet about you?
Right.
I mean, that is, think about how far we are down the political rabbit hole here.
So sad. It's sad.
And then I think, you know, you get into some more of the strategic things. Look, we are looking for those Republican and conservative-leaning independents who, you know, when a pollster calls, they do not self-identify as a Republican, right, that maybe they've changed their voter registration altogether,
right,
but have said, like, you know, this is not the party I signed up for. This is a president maybe I voted for, but I don't want to have anything more to do with. You know, if the sort of, you know, pillars of the conservative movement, you know, strong on national defense, fiscal responsibility and social conservatism, you know, are important. Well, this president has sort of either brushed them aside altogether or made mockeries of them in
right.
his own way. And so also, you know, I think our first video, if your folks want to look it up on our Lincoln Project YouTube, was a video related to Trump's support among these evangelical leaders, right? But the thing about the evangelical leaders who support him are that they are basically the church leaders that Trump would be if he were a church leader, right? Which is they ask for money or you're not going to get, you know, you won't find salvation. They've said things that are totally out of bounds from both a spiritual and a political, you know, perspective. Jim Baker, you know, is saying that, you know, if you're not going to be for Trump, then you're not saved. I mean, Jim Baker, who like literally violated every part of his thing. And so I think it's not just a matter of going after Donald Trump, but saying like, these people are claiming to speak for you, evangelicals. Are these really the people that speak for you? And then I think, you know, in some of those target states, right, like Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, you know, in a lot of these places, as I mentioned, those margins are very narrow. Right. So who are those people who maybe, you know, are turned off by Trump and how do we find them and communicate to them from with messaging and from messengers who they will listen to? Right.
Right.
And then I think also, you know, I think it was like 111 million voters didn't participate in 2016.
Amazing.
So how do we go find a million of those to show up? Right. And so, you know, that's what we'll be doing. You know, we have been overwhelmed by the level of support, both financial and grassroots, that we have experienced here. I think tomorrow or the 17th will be our 1 month anniversary since we launched. And I think the most important thing that we have found is that we clearly tapped into a reservoir of, you know, latent enthusiasm, and energy from folks who have been looking for someone to stand up and say enough is enough.
Well,
and you know what? That is our mission, and that's what we'll be doing between now and November 3rd.
Well, it's admirable work. I'm a strong supporter of the Lincoln Project myself, and would encourage, if you want to learn a little bit more about what they're doing and get involved, you can go to lincolnproject.us and check it out and learn for yourself exactly what they're doing and if they're in your neighborhood. And get involved and be a part of this election process. It's going to be an important one. Reed Galen, man, the time has flown by, man. I really appreciate you taking time out in the midst of all that you're doing on the Lincoln Project and your other deals to step into the conversation here at the podcast. We really, really do appreciate it.
No, thanks, Michael. It's great to be back with you.
Absolutely. Well, that was Reed Galen, folks. He's one of a kind. He's an independent political strategist, as I said, but he's one of the smart guys who's doing both the inside-outside game, trying to change the game for all of us in the United States as we kind of look ahead to the upcoming elections and what we the people must do in order to support and uphold our Constitution and the rule of law and all those things that right now kind of under fire. Well, that does it for this week. You know, I'm coming back because I love sitting in the chair and having fun with guests. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcasts on. Don't forget to download, you know, an episode or two or three. Certainly, you can find me on Twitter at Michael Steele, and you can find Reed Galen on Twitter at Reed Galen. That's R-E-E-D-G-A-L-E-N. All right, folks, that does it for this time. We'll catch y'all later. Peace out.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to LostGolfBalls.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands, in stock, 50% off retail. LostGolfBalls.com.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand-new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.